Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's International Women's Day and the strikes and protests it has generated around the world, and speak with Ruth Rosen, a pioneering historian of gender and society who is Professor Emerita of History at UC Davis and a visiting professor at UC Berkeley. The author of The World Split Open: How the Modern Women's Movement Changed America. She joins us to discuss the second wave of feminism and how the women's movement has moved from consciousness raising to hell raising, with an extraordinary grassroots mobilization of women across the country and around the world that took to the streets in record numbers on the day after Trump's inauguration. She will also give us a history of International Women's Day that began in New York in 1908 and was largely ignored for decades during the Cold War as being too socialist until relatively recently. And today it even got a blessing from Donald Trump, who tweeted that, quote, he has tremendous respect for women. Then, since Donald Trump's extraordinary smear of President Obama that he has yet to explain, justify, provide evidence, or apologize for, entered into the president's mind via a story in Breitbart News, we will examine a new study at the Columbia Journalism Review, Breitbart-led right-wing media ecosystem altered broader media agenda. One of the study's authors, Ethan Zuckerman, who directs the Center for Civil Media at MIT and teaches at MIT's Media Lab, joins us to discuss how the pro-Trump media sphere set the agenda for the conservative media and strongly influenced the broader media agenda, particularly to the detriment of Hillary Clinton. Then finally, we'll assess what China's foreign minister called the head-on collision course that the U.S. and North Korea are on, and the rejection by the U.S. representative to the UN of China's suggestion that the North Koreans should stop their nuclear and missile tests in exchange for the U.S. and South Korea ending military exercises. David Kung, a professor of international relations at USC and the director of the Asian Studies Center, joins us to discuss Nikki Haley's remark that North Korea's Kim Jong-un is not rational, and whether cutting him off from the SWIFT international banking system will moderate the regime's behavior. And joining us now is Ruth Rosen, who's a pioneering historian of gender and society and an award-winning journalist. She is a professor emerita of history at UC Davis and currently a visiting professor at UC Berkeley. She's also had a distinguished career writing for the San Francisco Chronicle, the Los Angeles Times, and her books include The Lost Sisterhood, Prostitution in America, and The World Split Open, How the Modern Women's Movement Changed America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Rosen.
Well, thank you, Ian.
And you were quoted extensively in a recent article in the New York Times from consciousness raising to hell raising about the second wave of feminism. So in the context of what's happening today with International Women's Day and a number of demonstrations around the world and a number of women going on strike, is there obviously, the day after the inauguration was an extraordinary event that took place. Millions of women around the world protested and around the nation. So are we in a situation where we have a resistance in search of strategy?
No, I don't think so. I think we have an aspiration that is actually in action right now. I mean, you know it when Trump decides to applaud the women's strike today. I mean, there's an actual, I was just reading a quote on the web, you know, President Trump says this is a wonderful thing that women are celebrating International Women's Day. Well, let me just give some background to this. If he really knew what International Women's Day is, I don't think he would applaud it or cherish it. It began in 1908 in February, and then later it was changed to March. And 15,000 workers, who were women, marched through New York City, and they were demanding shorter hours, better pay, and the right to vote. And on the same day the next year, women staged another demonstration, this time with the blessing of the Socialist Party. And they continued to do this until 1913. And as socialists essentially transformed Russia into a Soviet communist state, the United States was unpatriotic to celebrate International Women's Day. And so people forgot about it in the United States. It just wasn't celebrated at all until, And this is where the connection between the second wave of feminism and the young generation that is so brilliantly organizing women-led strikes and marches really becomes clear. In 1969, a woman in Berkeley named Laura Moura, she read about the International Women's Day and decided to get a group of people in Berkeley, about 50 people, who marched downtown Berkeley in these very Victorian clothes, talking about better wages and all the things that women had talked about in 1908. And that picture went around quite a bit around the country. It was reprinted a lot. And what happened is, from one city, it spread to a dozen cities and then many dozens of cities. And so throughout, I'd say from 1969 till now, it's been celebrated by feminists here and there, but it hasn't been a national thing. Not everyone knows where it came from. Not everyone knows that it wasn't even celebrated between 1913 and 1969. What has happened is that the young women today are building on something. They're really looking at that history, and they're saying, why aren't we doing this? And they are not questioning that this is a ridiculous thing to do. I think they are extraordinary that four women got together and thought about a march on Washington for women. And the thing is, I also like the fact that it was a women's-led march, but it didn't exclude men, and nor was it about men particularly. In fact, I think the best speech, which I think really reflected how broad this feminism is, was by Kamala Harris, who's the senator of one of the senators of California. And she gave a wonderful speech, and she said, you want to know what women's issues are? Women's issues are health care. Women's issues are good pay. Women's issues. And she went on and on about all the climate change. And suddenly it became clear this women's led march wasn't about, oh, someone forgot to put the toilet seat down or didn't take care of the children. This was about everything. There was nothing she left out. And so once she said that, more and more people began to organize, knowing that International Women's Day was coming. And now there are people all over the country who have been arrested. Somehow President Trump is saying this is, but that's very strange. And what will happen is International Women's Day is always celebrated all over the world, but it just hasn't been in the United States because it was associated with communism. I don't know what will happen next year, but right now this is riding high on the Women's March on Washington.
And Ruth Rosen, how would you characterize the differences between the first wave of feminism and the second wave of feminism?
I think the big change is that we got together in small groups and tried to figure out what was wrong. We didn't even have a language for sexual harassment or battered women. We just didn't even have a language. We had two words to describe all the things that are really awful. That's life. But that's just the way it is. And the young women have a language, and we had to take a long time, sometimes months, sometimes a few years, to actually take a new language and put it into action, get laws changed, get executive orders passed, get legislative support for change. These young women are building on that, and they can go into action much faster with a great deal of knowledge, and many of them have bothered to read about the history of the first wave of feminism, the suffrage movement, getting just the vote, and they know that the second wave was about almost everything, but we didn't know how to talk about everything. We tried, but we failed about a lot of things because we didn't understand everything. I think what the broad spectrum of issues that's being discussed by people like Kamala Harris and describing women's issues as the same thing most radical men would talk about, climate change and health care and keeping Obamacare, I think this is fabulous. They are broadening what feminism is. And in that sense, they're making it even more acceptable and palatable to people who say, oh, well, yeah, I agree with equal work, equal pay, but, you know, I'm not a feminist.
Now, how much do you think there is has Donald Trump, obviously the day after his inauguration, it's pretty difficult not to notice the coincidence, right?
Right.
So let's assume that he's been the spark for some activism. One of the things I find extraordinary about what Trump and Bannon have done, but both of whom, by the way, have been accused of spousal abuse, he's cutting $480 million of grants from the DOJ, Department of Justice. These are grants to help eradicate violence against women. And every year, about 1,500 women in this country are murdered and beaten to death by their spouses. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think people will respond, and they will respond with marches and protests, because the law that authorized the Violence Against Women and Girls Act, it's both the UN and the United States, women have taken that very seriously. Even though I was surprised that women didn't vote against Trump because of his almost bragging definition of how wonderful it is to sexually assault women, the violence, I think, upsets women even more. And I don't know, I can't predict what will happen. Historians, you get your PhD and you put your hand up and say, I will not predict the future. But I really don't know. But I do think that there's an acceleration at this moment. I think he is a little bit worried, because I don't think he would have said such a positive thing about International Women's Day if he actually knew what it was about. Taking money out of violence against women is a very egregious act. I thought all the sexual harassment was a very egregious act. There has just never been a cabinet like this or men like this in office for an awfully long time who feel like it's perfectly free to talk about violence against women and sexual assault against women and think that's funny and that it's glamorous and it's macho and it makes them look bigger, makes them look pathetic, in my view. I don't know what's going to happen, but I think that, ironically, as you've pointed out, when he does these things, he educates people, because a lot of people get very, very angry. It didn't keep him from being elected, which I'm sorry. I thought more women would be appalled by all his statements about sexual assault and his almost acceptance of that as a norm. But maybe things will change. Because I would say one thing that I didn't mention before. One of the things that was in that New York Times article about me and other people is that the younger women are creating a thing called a huddle. They wanted to maintain the energy and excitement of the Women's March. And so they told women in all the different cities they'd come from, create huddles and talk about your lives, which is what we did in our consciousness-raising group. But they smartly didn't call it the same thing, because who wants to call something they're in just what their mother called it? So they called it a huddle, women's huddles. And that's what the article was mainly about, how it went from consciousness-raising to hell-raising, that these women are meeting and talking about their lives. And they can do it better, faster, and act on it much more quickly, because they know more than we did. It's 30, 40 years later. So these huddles may or may not actually activate a whole lot of women. I know a lot of women who are not working today, and people who would never have known that there was an International Women's Day, never heard of it before. In fact, they're not working, and they don't even know why. They just know they're not supposed to. I've talked to several people today who said, I didn't go to work today because it's Ladies' Day. And I thought, okay, maybe I should just let that go. But they didn't know it was International Women's Day. They just knew women should strike today. So there's some publicity that's really actually having an impact.
And when you say huddle, I mean, is that a sort of like they do in football?
Well, it was an attempt to sort of take that image of football when men huddle and they strategize. Okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do a Hail Mary pass. We're going to do that. A huddle is, in a way, a getting together. It's secret, and it's a strategic moment. And I wasn't there when that name was created, so I really can't say where it came from. But that's the first image I had, that this is like football. It's where you strategize.
So, I mean, I imagine we'll learn that Donald Trump's daughter had some influence on him and perhaps told him that it was a good idea to endorse this event today.
Yes.
Even though, as you pointed out, had he known about its political origins, he may not be, be doing so.
I mean, everything he's against was what they were for in 1908.
Right.
No, if he he really knew this. Right. He would have ignored it.
Yeah, but he just doesn't pay his workers.
That's right.
Male or female.
That's right.
To that extent, he's an equal opportunity rip-off artist. But
absolutely.
But of course, Ivanka's clothing line is actually apparently doing booming business, which is an extraordinary thing that you have a president of the United States who actually does bring the antiquated and ancient emoluments clause into play. But what is your sense then of, just in terms of the second wave of feminism, what was this recent furore over the young British actress who posed on Vanity Fair and got very upset that she was attacked as being anti-feminist when she insists that she's quite a active feminist?
I didn't see the Vanity Fair. How was she dressed?
Well, it seemed like she was dressed in a really pretty, you know, white kind of almost bridal type of dress. But
Was it like a Kelly Conway?
Yeah, lots of cleavage. That was, I guess.
I think whoever was against that or who was attacking her, as they do Kellyanne, I don't think it's necessarily sexist. I think what it is saying, you know, women are not valuable just because of their appearance, but for what they can achieve and their character. And I think that when people get angry at that kind of clothing on anchors, on television, or Kellyanne Conway, some people said, oh, she's just like Hillary Clinton, and people are sexist and they're against. But, you know, Hillary Clinton would never have sat on a sofa in the Oval Office with her shoes on. There's a certain inappropriate kind of femininity and almost a childness to some of this. And I think that people respond to that and say, you know, this doesn't look like a serious woman. But I don't know what other people think. And when I see that, I think this is not the way to look serious. I don't think you have to wear a man's suit to look serious, but I don't think you have to dress like a five-year-old either.
Well, obviously, some people find it difficult to deal with, you know, very, very clever right-wing women. I mean, she's very, very good at what she does.
Yes.
And I don't understand why, you know, well, what's your sense then of when she claims to be a feminist? How does that resonate with you?
I don't know enough about her. And I would have to talk to her and find out what she cares about, because feminism is a social justice movement. And I don't know if I would hear those words or the implications of those words from her. So I don't think I have the right to call her a feminist or not. I would need to know what she stands for.
Well, it is a moment now where, as I started out, Ruth Rosenwood, positing the notion of so much political energy out there and perhaps in search of strategy, and you didn't agree with that entirely, but it does seem, though, that the one thing that we can say is that given the extraordinary nature of this presidency that may not last long because this person in the White House does appear to be unstable and very immature and dangerously so. That this is a moment for the political opposition to emerge. So what's your sense then? You know, there, of course, the House Democrats took place in a day without a woman strike on the steps of the Congress, etc. But, and obviously it's difficult being in the opposition, but where do you see the actual political translation of all of this spontaneous activism that was out today and on the day after Trump's inauguration?
Well, I agree with you that the opposition, women and men who are against Trump, are in search of strategy because he is the president and he has both houses from his party. So he has the power to repeal health care and all kinds of good things. So I agree with you that everyone is searching for strategies. People are choosing to do things that we did in the 60s, which are, on the one hand, big protests, marches, getting arrested, calling attention to injustice. But you're right. They are also looking for strategies that are new. And one thing that really was new, that this was a women's-led march, and they invited men and women to come with them, but they took the leadership, and that's new. And you're right, that's a new strategy.
And do you think then that is there a way to reach Donald Trump's supporters? In other words,
I really don't know. I really think we live on different planets sometimes.
Right.
I just, one night I was watching NPR, I think it was CBS, and they were interviewing a woman in Texas who had breast cancer. And she said it would be fine with her if Obamacare were repealed, even though she would lose her all the treatment she has, and that would mean her death. And the reason was that just based on principle, she didn't want anyone from the government to tell her that she had a mandate and had to pay for premium. You know, I sat there with my mouth open, and then a brother-in-law in our family came around and said, you know, I'm so angry that my premiums are going up. I'm voting for Trump. And we said to him, do you realize that you're going to have zero premiums then? You're going to pay nothing because you're not going to even have medical insurance? And he said, oh, I haven't ever thought of it that way. So people are very, very, well, sometimes I think they're not thinking it through. Sometimes they're confusing Affordable Care Act with Obamacare. Sometimes I think it's just racism and anything Obama did is bad because of his color of his skin. I mean, the things that people say, I don't know how to answer that, Ian. I really sometimes think the people on different planets.
Well, I think, unfortunately, just in closing, it does seem that in order for his followers to get buyer's remorse and recognize the extent to which they've been conned, the rest of the country has to go through an enormous amount of collateral damage.
Tremendous. And when so many of his constituents are exactly part of a very large group, millions probably, just millions, who will lose the kind of health care that we finally got. Will they realize that this is a really horrible thing when they see members of their family die? I don't know if they can connect these things, because he is a really terrific showman, and people have really responded to that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, and I'm very grateful for your time and that you weren't completely on strike today.
No, I wanted to be, but I had to take care of things because other people were on strike. So that's just the way it goes.
Well,
a lot of women I know are on strike, not going to work, and I'm really glad.
Well, again, I've been speaking with Ruth Rosen, and I thank you.
Thank you, Ian. Nice talking to you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Ruth Rosen, who is a pioneering historian of gender and society and award-winning journalist. She's a professor emerita of history at UC Davis and currently a visiting professor at UC Berkeley. And she's also had a distinguished career writing for the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, and her books include The Lost Sisterhood, Prostitution in America, and The World Split Open, How the Modern Women's Movement Changed America. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Breitbart News influences President Trump's mind and look into the new study, Breitbart-led right-wing media ecosystem altered broader media agenda. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ethan Zuckerman, who directs the Center for Civil Media at MIT and teaches at MIT's Media Lab. He is the co-founder of the blogging community Global Voices, author of Rewire, Digital Cosmopolitans in the Age of Connection, and co-author of a new study at Columbia Journalism Review, Breitbart-led right-wing media ecosystem altered broader media agenda. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ethan Zuckerman.
Great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Ethan. And clearly, Breitbart has a lot of influence. And at this moment, perhaps President Trump is regretting some of the influence, in as much as it seems like his outburst on Twitter recently, where he called the former president bad, a sick guy, among other things. That clearly is still out there and has created quite a lot of anger, disgust, etc. So to begin with, is this your sense that President Trump himself, with Stephen Bannon from Breitbart and also Stephen Miller, both of whom are his two closest advisors and who I think have more face time with him perhaps than anybody else, do you think that Breitbart is an influence on this president?
Well, Breitbart's an enormous influence on this president. What we study in this paper is essentially how people are paying attention to different corners of the media during the election campaign. So my colleagues over at Harvard University and I use a tool that we've jointly developed between their lab and mine called Media Cloud. We collected over a million stories during the 18 months of the election. We also went into Twitter and collected more than 4 million tweets about the election, and then looked to see what media people pointed to. When we look at the media that was most influential during the election, there's some very familiar names there: CNN, The New York Times, The Washington Post. There's some media that's very familiar if you're a political junkie in the U.S., The Hill. And then the only other media that's at that level of influence is Breitbart. Where Breitbart is quite different is that Breitbart is only really linked to and pointed to by the far right. And what our study essentially finds is that in terms of media leaning, in terms of where they're getting their information, the Republican Party functionally split in two during this election. There is a part of the Republican Party that continues to get its information from mainstream media. They're paying attention to things like the Wall Street Journal, as well as CNN, as well as things like Fox News. But then there's this far right, this nationalist right, which pays attention to Breitbart above and beyond everything else.
But what explains the fact that Donald Trump apparently spends hours and hours every day, and particularly into the night, watching cable news, quite often MSNBC, which is not often very friendly towards his? Obviously, he watches Fox a lot and appears on Fox a lot. But so he seems to watch a lot of cable, but essentially, quote, Breitbart.
Well, first of all, to answer your question about why the leader of the free world is spending hours every night watching cable TV, you would really need a psychologist rather than a media theorist. But I think what's happening is that Trump is really influenced by two types of media. He's heavily influenced by what he's seeing on Twitter, and Breitbart is incredibly powerful on Twitter. And then he's very interested in what's coming up on those cable networks. And certainly Fox News has been paying a lot of attention to what gets talked about on Breitbart. One of the other findings that we have in the paper is that Breitbart really ends up sort of influencing how the Republican narrative as a whole goes. Early on in the campaign, Breitbart is the source that is predominantly talking about immigration. More than any of the other right-wing sources out there, Breitbart is really focused on this idea that the U.S. needs to close its borders, needs to get to zeroed immigration. And that information, first of all, clearly influences Trump. This is where we get the build a wall. But over time, it also clearly sways Fox News. Fox News comes over to that narrative over time. But we really see Breitbart inserting, first of all, Trump the candidate into the narrative. When we go back and sort of rewind the tape back, we see Fox News spending a lot of time on Rubio and a lot of time on Cruz. Breitbart comes out swinging for Trump very early on, sees him as someone who will push forward this anti-immigration agenda, and essentially fights with Fox News until they come along and sort of start singing from the same hymn book after it becomes clear that Trump is going to be the party's nominee. So, you know, they have very much been in Trump's camp from early on. Our sense is that they are quite good at setting the agenda, even for the TV news programs. Why Trump finds himself watching MSNBC, it may be some of the same emotions that I get when I watch Fox News. Maybe occasionally the passions that come from that are helpful. But I think in terms of how this fits with Breitbart, Breitbart is simply just a dominant player within the ecosystem as we see it.
So what happened then with Facebook, and how important was that? My understanding is that what happened there was that, I don't know whether it was Breitbart, Bannon, or somebody on the Republican side, should have been public knowledge to everybody that, and it's quite an extraordinary thing, that between 3/4 and 2/3 of Americans get their news from Facebook. What happened was that there was a sort of a push against Zuckerberg on the basis of they were alleging that his news curation was liberally biased. And and he got rid of the human curators and brought in algorithms. And a lot of people have tracked from that moment, that's when fake news started to appear. So was that a strategy? Did Zuckerberg roll over?
Sure. Well, let's unpack a couple of things in that. So the specific case with Facebook had to do with a category called trending news. So this is a way that Facebook sort of lets you see, here are news stories that a lot of users are talking about. That feed was manually curated because sometimes things trend and they're not necessarily news stories. Perhaps you don't want to have all of your news be celebrity news. You might want to go in and select and say, let's have some international news, some domestic news in there. So it was a part of the system where there was some editorial control. A former member of the team that worked on the editorial control of that, someone who made very clear that his politics are right-wing, claimed that the team didn't want to let right-wing news trend. And this made people very upset because they saw Facebook as a neutral platform. They didn't want to see any editorial intervention in there. The Facebook team said, great, we'll take humans out of the loop. We'll try to go to automated curation. And then, yes, what happened was it's become easier for fake news to make it into that specific category. So while all of that's true, what we would say in our study, we actually didn't see an enormous amount of evidence that fake news, which is to say stuff made up of whole cloth, was particularly influential. What we found a lot more of is what we would refer to as disinformation. So this sort of model of fake news where a teenager in Macedonia or someone in their living room in the U.S. simply makes up a story entirely and tries to get it to trend, that was not particularly influential in our set. What was far more influential was news coming from some of these hyperpartisan sites that had a mix of some fact, some what we might call familiar fiction, and a lot of almost the sort of tortured fever logic with, you know, here's something that we found in the WikiLeaks emails. We believe this ties to this conspiracy theory about Clinton, and here's evidence that the whole ecosystem is against us. It's a different beast than fake news, the way that people traditionally think about it. Is Facebook good at spreading it? Sure. I think social media in general is good at spreading highly emotive content, and that's in part how this information sorts of spreads. But what we end up sort of seeing about this is not so much the story about fake news, but the story about these essentially propaganda echo chambers. There are a large number of far right-wing sites. They're simply not read by anyone who is outside of that community. And they feed stories to Breitbart. Breitbart feeds stories to them. What this means is that when someone encounters a story with a questionable claim, if they're a member of that community, they might go over to the Washington Examiner or to the Daily Caller or to InfoWars, and that might be how they try to verify and confirm that story. But all of those sources are, again, within this sort of far-right echo chamber. It makes it very, very hard for these stories to be debunked.
And the other aspect of some of the Monday morning quarterbacking vis-a-vis how Bannon used social media in this last campaign, and the assumption is that they were much cleverer because they spent so much less than Hillary Clinton did and won, albeit rather narrowly, and of course they were 3 million behind in the popular vote. But nevertheless, the name that keeps coming up is Cambridge Analytica. And now, of course, the New York Times just recently did a sort of, I don't know whether you'd call it a debunking, but they sort of demystified it and suggested that maybe it's not this extraordinarily clever use of data mining social media and targeting different little micro communities, etc., which was the assumption that has led to a lot of people thinking that somehow this was the means by which Trump won the elections. What's your take on the role of Cambridge Analytica, both in Brexit and in the Trump campaign?
Sure. So every time there's a successful political campaign, at least in the U.S., someone looks to find a technological tool responsible for the victory. And occasionally, this usually works very, very well for building someone's career. So whoever was Obama's data director suddenly finds himself a highly marketable commodity. In the Trump campaign, because there wasn't necessarily a ton of data analytics within the campaign itself, Cambridge Analytica basically stood up and tried to claim that spotlight. The trick, of course, is that I don't actually think the targeting during the Trump campaign was particularly skillful. The Trump campaign bought a lot of very inexpensive inventory. If you were white and male and used Facebook, there's a very good chance that you were getting a flood of pro-Trump ads. It'd be hard for my politics to be classified as anything that is fairly far to the left, and I found myself sort of drowning in those ads, which suggests that it certainly wasn't brilliant targeting. It might have been sort of big swaths of targeting. But I think what everyone is sort of starting to find, particularly when you look at other people who've worked with psychometrics and targeting, it's deeply overrated. Most people who've worked on this suggest that you might be able to have a very small nudge in some select cases, but it's certainly not the sort of thing that swings elections. So I would say that this is just a case where a private business radically overhyped itself, and everyone is so desperately looking for an explanation of what happened that there was a lot of credulity about the story. But certainly smart people in the space have been saying, you know, for a couple of months now that they weren't actually all that impressed by Cambridge Analytica. They weren't running out to go ahead and use it. So what I would say is what we got out of our study was not so much a sense of the incredible power of psychometric targeting. We got a sense of the power of existing mainstream media. One of the really tremendous, enormous things people talk about on social media is the news. And they tend to point to traditional news organizations. When I listed off some of those highly influential news organizations, they're the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN. The digitally native ones, and this is quite interesting, in many cases tend to be these far-right ones. The far-right is almost entirely new media, and I mean new in the sense that almost all of it comes from since 2008 or so. This is really an ecosystem that developed under Obama, and that's at least where we think the influence came in this particular case.
But just in terms of quantifying the influence in terms of the pro-Trump media sphere, setting the agenda for the conservative media sphere, but also strongly influencing the broader media agenda and particular coverage of Hillary Clinton, the latter seems to be, I'm quoting from an article, obviously, the latter seems to be fairly successful. Because why was it that everybody kept talking about Hillary Clinton's server? And even Bernie Sanders had to say, enough already on the damn server. But it really did seem to be very effective that they went, that these were the things that dominated the headlines endlessly. And not Russia's involvement or alleged involvement in the election.
Well, that's right. So first of all, it isn't news that American election coverage is not very good. And by not very good, what I mean is it's a known bug that we focus on the horse race rather than on the issues. One of the things that we did in this study is out of this set of, you know, 1.25 million stories, we're able to analyze the text. And so we did searches to categorize stories as about immigration or about jobs or about any number of different issues. And we also categorized them as being about different scandals. The only issue that gets significant attention is the Trump framing of the immigration issue. All the other debates about the future of work, the future of healthcare, they get very, very little attention when you compare them to either Trump's scandals or Hillary's scandals. So Trump manages to get more attention for immigration than he does for his well-publicized problems with accusations of sexual harassment. But even those end up paling in comparison to coverage of Clinton and Benghazi, coverage of Clinton and email. And of course, at the very end of the election, we see this quite odd decision by the FBI to announce that there's further investigation of Clinton, and that essentially knocks the narrative of Trump's problems with sexual harassment out of the news at a very critical time in the election. So we come away from this essentially going, first of all, the media is certainly not doing a very good job if the job is to tell us what these candidates think about issues. The debate is simply not about issues. It's about scandals. Why are these scandals so powerful? I think part of what happens is that the media has gotten very used to being accused of having a left-wing bias. And in fact, when we look at our diagram, news sources like the New York Times and the Washington Post, they're read quite a bit more by the left than by the right. This doesn't mean that they have a bias. It does mean that their readership has a skew associated with it. But I think when you're accused of bias, one of the simplest ways to sort of add false balance to the mix is to weigh very heavily the information that's critical of your candidate. So I think one of the ways that media sources try to essentially defend themselves is by sort of bending over to play the scandals of the other side. And I think that helps explain why this email story got so much traction, even in these allegedly left-wing sources like the New York Times.
Well, just in closing, though, Benghazi, of course, was essentially a phony issue, and to a large extent, so was Hillary Clinton's emails server. But the video of Donald Trump talking about grabbing women's genitals was real. So how is it that something that's essentially made up could dominate the headlines and have that kind of damaging effect, whereas something that was right there, you know, in front of you, absolutely irrefutable, didn't have much of an impact, or apparently not as much impact as the Benghazi and Hillary server?
It's a fantastic question. I think anyone who is running a contemporary newsroom should be asking themselves questions about whether they were essentially taken in during this campaign. We certainly find in our study quite an ugly picture of what people were willing to pay attention to. And the very simple picture is that they were more interested in Trump talking about the issues than about Trump's scandals. And they were way more interested in Hillary's scandals than Hillary's issues. And, you know, at the end of the day, it was a deeply unlevel playing field. And what we're sort of hoping to do in this is we're putting nice quantitative rich data sets in front of people and essentially saying, look, this is what we see and we think our methodology is pretty sound. Should this give you pause about how you're running your newsroom? It certainly gives us pause when we look at the data.
Well, though, just in closing, though, in general, the country itself seems unmoored because there's no consensus anymore about what is true. People are retreating into these silos. Liberals getting their news from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, Breitbart, and even further to the right, and et cetera, and Christians get their own news. Is there any hope on the horizon in the work that you've done to suggest that we can return to some kind of collective societal consensus on some of the basic truths?
So unfortunately, I actually have to question your premise. One of the big findings that we find in the paper is that this polarization and this isolation is disproportionately true on the right and not on the left. On the left, we see much more linking to a wider variety of the ideological spectrum. It's on the far right that we see this really quite insulated echo chamber centered around Breitbart. So I think there is this danger of false balance. We want to sort of look at a narrative and say, we're all going mad. The internet is driving us to distraction. We can all isolate ourselves. Our data doesn't show that. What it does show is that at the very far right of the country, there is a level of isolation going on that's quite uncomfortable and that we don't quite know what to do with. And, you know, honestly, I think in many ways, these conversations are going to happen within the Republican Party. They're going to happen within the Libertarians. They're going to really have to look at, does the right in this country want to be divorced from consensus reality? Because, unfortunately, that's essentially what we're seeing in the study that we've done.
Well, Ethan Zuckerman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Ethan Zuckerman, who directs the Center for Civil Media at MIT and teaches at MIT's Media Lab. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back assessing what China's foreign minister called a head-on collision course that the U.S. and North Korea are on.
Bruce Rodner!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich!
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith!
Sit down, man.
Like it said again. Whoa.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Kung, who's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and director of the Asian Studies Center. He is the author of China Rising, Peace, Power, and Order in East Asia, and his latest book is East Asia Before the West, Five Centuries of Trade and Tribute. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Kung.
Thanks for having me.
And China has called on North Korea to suspend its nuclear and missile tests, etc., in exchange for the U.S. and South Korea halting their military exercises. And they use the head-on collision analogy. And just to quote the Chinese foreign minister, the two sides are like two accelerating trains coming towards each other with neither side willing to give way. The question is, are the two sides really ready for a head-on collision? Our priority now is to flash the red light and apply the brakes on both trains. Well, it hasn't worked. The U.S. UN Secretary, U.S. Representative of the U.N., and Nikki Haley basically said, no, we're not ready to make any concessions to North Korea. So does that mean that the collision could happen?
I doubt it. Both sides have been on collision course for, you know, for decades, for 20 years, and then we veer off at the last moment. It's one reason that everyone calls it a very tense situation, because it has to be managed carefully. So this one, it's dangerous, yes. But neither side, and here's the thing, that there's two interesting things about this. First is, neither side is claiming that they're going to do a first strike. Both the U.S. and North Korea claim that if the other starts a war, they'll start back. So far, we still don't have anyone claiming to have a surprise attack. So I don't think that's the collision course. But the other point is that China has been making this point for years, and they're just making it much more bluntly now than before, which is that we cannot simply punish North Korea. We have to be willing to negotiate with it as well. The United States is clearly not ready to go there. So we're in the same place that we've been essentially for quite some time.
But China is, in effect, punishing South Korea for accepting the deployment of the THAAD anti-missile system, which they think basically limits their nuclear deterrence. And South Korea has developed some very lucrative cultural and business ties with China. So North Korea is apparently quite happy about that turn of events. So is North Korea responsible, in effect? They raise the nuclear ante, and then South Korea gets nervous, wants a defense against missiles, and then it screws up the South's relations with China.
And that's how complex this is, because the THAAD Terminal High Altitude Air Defense System is ostensibly against North Korea. It's actually has much more influence on China, and so this is deeply intertwined. And one of the things about that is, I am extremely skeptical that it's going to work, and I think that many people in South Korea and in America are getting sold a bill of sale here, because we talk about it as if you press a button and it's like a force field, and the missiles will bounce off. And the reality is there's almost no proof that it will actually work. Even the deployment of it, I think, raises tensions, but doesn't at all materially help South Korea defend itself.
Well, I mean, North Korea, of course, has really irritated China. My understanding is that the older brother, half-brother, who was assassinated in the most extraordinary way with VX nerve gas at an airport in Malaysia, that has led to tensions between Malaysia and North Korea, and one of the few countries that actually allowed North Koreans to come without visas. Now, Malaysians are absolutely trapped in North Korea, and the Malaysians have reciprocated by trapping North Koreans in Malaysia. And, of course, China is mad because they were grooming the older brother as a possible hedge against this erratic younger leader now, Kim Jong-un. So how seriously do you think the cutoff of imports of coal, is that a slap on the wrist or a real rebuke?
Well, again, I mean, this is the thing. There's a lot of stuff going on, but fundamentally, what we have to do is see a actual change in Chinese foreign policy. They've been annoyed at North Korea for a long time. The North Koreans have not trusted the Chinese for a long time. But fundamentally, the Chinese haven't been willing to turn the screws. We are seeing, potentially, that China is limiting the amount of coal imports from North Korea, although it's very hard to judge. There's actually rumor that there was a North Korean coal ship that literally just went from North Korea to China last week. So it's not at all clear that that's really going to happen. But even China calling out and saying these things publicly is at least a rhetorical shift. One thing I'd like to point out, when they talk about Kim Jong-nam, the older son of the current leader of North Korea who was assassinated in Malaysia, that China was grooming him or something like that, I want to point out, had there been any bodyguards at all, it's unlikely they could have assassinated him that way, because they just came up to him on the right in front, right? And, you know, if China really had four bodyguards around him or something, there's no way that could have happened. So for some reason, he didn't have any security details. So if China was grooming him, they were being quite lax in how they were actually protecting this guy.
So, David Kang, it does seem, though, it's very hard to the delinquent nation always sort of causes trouble and then gets in effect rewarded. And that's been their MO. And they have been under sanctions forever. But it seems like now, by cutting them off from the worldwide, it's called Society of Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, or SWIFT. That's real, and that's really going to hurt. Apparently, they have been cut off from SWIFT, so that their banks can't do any transactions outside of their own country. So do you think that's going to get the dear leader, the wonderful leader?
The young general?
The young general or the kid?
Yeah. Again, I have to say, I think, you know, part of the irony, so number one, yes, North Korea is being truly frozen out of the world financial system. And, you know, they did have trade with countries like Malaysia. So, yes, it will hurt. At the margins, it will hurt. The question comes down to this. Is it simply that we have not put enough pressure on North Korea? Pressure hasn't worked. The sanctions haven't worked. What do we got to do? More sanctions. That's the logic behind, well, we have had them under literally 50 years of sanctions, and essentially those haven't been enough. We need to do even more. I have to say, I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical that a little more pressure this time will make a difference, when North Korea already is one of the most heavily sanctioned countries in the world and has been the most isolated country in the world for years and years and years, right? So is it really that just a little bit more pressure will work? I mean, maybe, but I doubt it. My sense is North Koreans are ready to meet pressure with pressure their own. They have a lot of tools at their disposal to make life miserable for most of us. And that's one reason that as we go down this collision course, both the U.S. and North Korea ultimately end up saying deterrence works. Let's not actually go that final step. And we end up in the same position where North Korea is isolated, relatively poor, a couple countries are willing to trade with it, but has some real possibility to make trouble and war. And we have some tools, but we're not also willing to go to war. And so we're sort of stuck. And so I'm not sure that actually, you know, just a little more pressure will work.
Right. But at the rhetorical level, when you have the U.S. representative to the U.N., Nikki Haley, saying Kim Jong-un is, mm-hmm. quote, not rational. And even here in the United States, a lot of people are beginning to wonder how rational and stable and emotionally mature our president is, given his predilection for tweeting in the middle of the night, saying horrible, horrible things about his predecessor. So do you think that's an added reason why we should be concerned and that maybe the Chinese foreign minister is not totally off the mark?
Well, again, I don't want to downplay. I mean, this is always serious because, of course, North Korea can do a lot of damage. So we don't treat it lightly. Is he actually irrational? Is he actually crazy? Is another question. And part of the parlor game or the sort of debates that we have, those of us who watch North Korea, are the assassinations and the removal of top military leaders and his uncle. Is that a sign of strength or is that a sign of weakness? And a lot of people think it's a sign of weakness, that he's getting more irrational, he's having to kill people, et cetera, et cetera. Others think that it's a sign of strength, that you can do this and you can show that you can get away with it and you're forcing everyone else to get in line. And you're saying, look, this is what's going to happen to you if you don't follow orders. So it's not clear how I would interpret what's been going on with the regime or with Kim Jong-un. I mean, he's been in power for 5 years. He's clearly able to hold power enough to forestall any coup d'etat or palace intrigue. So he pretty clearly knows what he's doing.
Well, but just in closing, though, you always get back to the fact that, one, China doesn't want the North to collapse because of the impact of refugees, etc. They also don't want the U.S. Army on the Yellow River, which is what prompted them to get into the Korean War. And also, I think China actually gets a kind of certain schadenfreude out of the idea that North Korea drives American military planets crazy because they're you know, you have stable deterrence with China and the U.S., but you don't have stable deterrence with North Korea, and their missiles do threaten the U.S. Pacific fleet. So is that what China's really about? They don't mind the North Koreans driving the Americans crazy?
I would agree, yes. In essence, yes. But I would make it even broader than that. And this is the real tragedy of where we are on the peninsula, which is this. Everybody knows how to play this game of deterrence and stalemate. We don't like it. It's not good. But we all know and essentially have played deterrence and stalemate since 1953. Nobody has a good idea of what happens if you knock over North Korea. Nobody has a really good plan to solve North Korea. Almost nobody wants to open up trade. I mean, you know, nobody is saying they're just a normal country. We should trade with them. So nobody wants to treat them like a normal country. Nobody wants to take the chance on starting a war. And so we're stuck. And that's the tragedy, is that we are in the same place with the same debates about hit them with a stick or give them a carrot that we've been for a long time.
Well, David Kung, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Kung, who's professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and director of the Asian Studies Center. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.